A book entitled Czech-Irish Cultural Relations between 1900 and 1950 may sound a little obscure, but this slim volume, published last year by the Centre for Irish Studies of Prague's Charles University, is anything but a dull, dry thesis. The book covers a hugely interesting and complex period during which Ireland emerged from centuries of rule from London and Czechoslovakia arose from the ashes of the Habsburg Empire. David Vaughan picks up the story in this week's Czech Books.
The book's author is Daniel Řehák, publishing under the pseudonym Daniel Samek from the Institute for Czech Literature. And his study of Czech-Irish cultural relations in the first half of the 20th century begins with a glance at the period before the First World War. Cultural links between the Czechs and the Irish went back centuries. Irish Franciscans had fled to Prague to escape persecution by Queen Elizabeth way back at the end of the 16th century. From the mid-17th century, one of the most influential Bohemian noble families, which included the 19th century Austrian Prime Minister Eduard Taaffe, also hailed from Ireland. They even had a folly built on their estate in West Bohemia, made to look like their ancestral castle in Ireland. And even James Joyce has a Czech link. His sister Eileen married František Šaurek, a Czech working at the branch of the Živnostenská bank in Trieste. Here is what Daniel Řehák's book tells us on the subject.
A reported story of the 1914 wedding has Joyce stay faithful to his reputation of a punster, as he predicted a fruitful union based on the conjunction of jajce, eggs in Croatian, and the pronunciation frequently given to Joyce's name by speakers of South Slavonic languages, and šourek, scrotum, in Czech. It was due to šourek, originally Joyce's student in a language course, that several Czech expressions and toponyms found their way into the author's magnum opus, Finnegan's Wake. Because of the letters he sent to his sister Eileen and František Šaurek, who were living in Prague during World War I, the Irish writer was put on the list of Czech arch-traitors by the Austrian secret police at the beginning of the war. This, however, happened only due to a curious blunder resulting from the fact that the secret policemen were unable to determine Joyce's origin, and most likely his actual occupation either. Like the Šaureks, Joyce later returned to Trieste, where he frequently met members of the Jewish community and found their inspiration for Leopold Bloom, protagonist of Ulysses. Mr. Bloom was modeled on two gentlemen, a Hungarian Jew by the name of Louis Bloom and a Czech Jew called Leopold Popper.
Between the First and the Second World War, Czech-Irish links developed rapidly. At a diplomatic level, the reason was pragmatic. Daniel Řehák.
Koncem 20. let, kdy se Británie začala bránit záplavě československého zboží.
At the end of the 1920s, Britain began trying to protect its markets from a flood of goods made in Czechoslovakia, so Ireland seemed a good alternative. Czechoslovak exporters put pressure on the government in Prague to open a diplomatic mission in Dublin. The main focus was to be trade, to find markets for sugar, machinery and shoes.
To znamená získat nová odbytiště pro cukr, stroje a samozřejmě boty.
The man chosen for the job was Major Pavel Růžička, a charismatic figure who had fought in the First World War in the famous Czechoslovak legions in Russia.
Využil irského osamostatňovacího procesu v rámci britského společenství.
He took advantage of Ireland's growing independence. Not only did he manage to get Czech and Sudeten German experts on the sugar processing industry over to Ireland and secure the import of machinery from Brno, but he also helped to reform the system of physical training for the newly emerging Irish army.
As a former soldier and World War I hero, Růžička had become a good friend of the Defence Minister, Alan Aiken. And Aiken was enthusiastic when Růžička suggested setting up a system based directly on the so-called Sokol training back home in Czechoslovakia. The Sokol movement, Sokol means falcon in Czech, had been going strong since the 19th century as a patriotic gymnastics organization and had become one of the symbols of the Czech national revival. By the 1930s, It was also one of the largest sports organizations in the world. We pick up the story in Daniel Rehak's book.
Collective exercise, subordinated to an aesthetic ideal and underscored by music, found avid adherents in Ireland. The musical accompaniment for Irish Sokols was first provided by Czech rally compositions, while the creation of Irish music for the purpose was eventually suggested. The task was performed by a music teacher from an army school, John Francis Larchett, who regularly met with Consul Ruzicka.
The degree of Irish enthusiasm for the Sokol movement is reflected in an interview that the Irish publisher L.P. Byrne gave to Czechoslovak radio when he visited the huge Sokol gymnastics display that took place in Prague in the summer of 1938. The recording is crackly, but I don't think it's hard to pick up his enthusiasm, even through the background noise.
I had seen those magnificent pictures. 50,000 men engaged in physical exercise on a vast field. The picture fascinated. The thing itself was even more fascinating. Glamorous, magnificent, tremendous. Something that people in Western Europe do not realize from the picture presented. Something which needs to be seen, felt and experienced to get the inner spirit and the force and the power behind that magnificent organization. To get the 20th century as against a Greek background.
That was the Irish publisher L.P. Byrne admiring the Czech Sokol movement in 1938. But not everyone in Ireland was enthusiastic about Sokol. Daniel Řehák continues.
Zároveň se ovšem ozvaly hlasy z katolických kruhů.
Voices from Catholic circles began to make themselves heard, vehemently criticizing the idea of introducing the physical education methods of Sokol in Ireland, because Sokol was known as a movement built on free thinking, and if anything was anti-Catholic. Instead, there were calls for Ireland to develop its own system based on Gaelic games.
Under this pressure, Ružička's initiative foundered, although not before hundreds of young Irish had been given a taste of physical education, Central European style. Being immensely sociable, Pavel Ružička was an ideal diplomat, supported by his wife Svatova, who was much celebrated for her cooking. They rapidly became the best known and most popular figures in Dublin diplomatic circles. And Ružička was also a man of many talents. Among other things, he was an accomplished musician and musical manager, arranging for the Czech Philharmonic to come to Dublin and also the celebrated Prague String Quartet, here playing part of Dvořák's quartet in A flat major on a recording from the period. The Prague String Quartet, which visited Ireland several times during Pavel Ružička's stay in Dublin. I've already mentioned that the Bohemian aristocratic Taffa family had roots in Ireland. In the mid-1930s, Count Edward Taffa, grandson of the one-time Austrian Prime Minister, found himself sinking into ever greater financial difficulty. He eventually sold the family estate of Naljove and moved permanently to Ireland, an event that did not go unnoticed in Dublin. At one time, Daniel Rehak's book tells us, Taffa was even considered as a nominee for President of Ireland, a full 300 years after his ancestors had left the country and made their fortune in Bohemia in the Thirty Years' War. In 1936, the consul, Pavel Ružička, was forced by ill health to return to Prague, and he was replaced in the Dublin posting by Karel Košťál, who played an interesting role during World War II when Czechoslovakia was occupied.
Jeho nástupce, konzul Karel Košťál, nevydal konzulát Němců.
Košťál did not hand over the embassy to the Germans, but held out throughout the war. In the uneasy atmosphere of neutral Dublin, he even did some spying on the Germans. It was thanks to his efforts that after the war the consulate was raised to the level of embassy.
Diplomat vystřídal Karla Košťála.
Košťál returned to Prague, and Pavel Růžička came back once again to Dublin in 1947. This time, Daniel Řehák's book tells us, with the full status of ambassador.
When the communist takeover happened in Czechoslovakia in February 1948, Ambassador Pavel Růžička soon got his bearings, being an ex-legionnaire who had personal memories of Soviet Russia. He convened a press conference where he outlined what was happening in Prague without any ambiguity and proclaimed that he would not serve the communists. He assembled the archive of the Czechoslovak mission and dispatched it to the embassy in London. The communists tried to woo Růžička back home, promising him a pension. When the effort failed, they proceeded to confiscate all his property. Růžička subsequently occupied the embassy building and confiscated its furniture in reaction to his dispossession. The communists demanded redress of the Irish government. However, the Irish representatives sabotaged the matter due to the expulsion of the Apostolic Nuncio from Czechoslovakia and even went as far as refusing to issue visas to the liquidators of the embassy. The communists gave up their effort to regain control over the embassy in 1950 and closed down the mission to Dublin entirely.
Pavel Růžička and his wife Svatava remained in Dublin. But despite the Cold War, their work to build on Czech-Irish links did not end there.
The auspicious foundations of Czech-Irish cultural and economic relations were to be paralyzed for almost 50 years to come. The Růžičkas, who had become the epitome of all things Czech in Dublin for several decades, maintained their livelihood due to the culinary skills of Mrs. Růžička by producing continental delicacies for McGill's Oriental and Continental Foods, a shop located between Grafton Street and Clarendon Street.
Quite a contrast with the status they had known before the war, and both were fully aware that they would never return home. Pavel Růžička died in 1961, forgotten and ignored in Czechoslovakia, but much loved in his adopted city of Dublin. It was to be another 30 years before Czech-Irish relations were able to build once again on the links that he had so carefully forged before the war, a period that you can read more about in Daniel Řehák's book Czech-Irish Cultural Relations, 1900 to 1950.
And that edition of Czech Books has brought us to the end of this half hour from